Welcome to the Extra Environmentalist. Your opposable thumb means nothing.
This is what we want to be. We don't want to be Americans or Germans or English. We want to be extra environmentalists. Always feel wherever you go that you are a stranger. The outsider, the one looking in. This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Sunny, yesterday my heart was filled with rain. Sunny, you smiled at me and really eased the pain. Oh, the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Hello and welcome to The Extra Environmentalist. I'm your host, Seth Moserkatz, along with my co-host, Justin Ritchie. And today, we are talking about the collapse of America.
Oh, no. Wow.
Not really the collapse, Justin. I know you get scared when I say that, but we're talking with an author who thinks a lot about the collapse of America and has written several books on the topic, hasn't he?
Well, not even the collapse of the United States, but even more so the decline of American culture and how that results in an eventual collapse. And, you know, we're living in the days of decline and collapse right now. We see it all around us. And what we're talking with author Morris Berman about today is his most recent book, Why America Failed. And that's the third book in his America trilogy, which started with Twilight of American Culture and then followed up by Dark Ages America. And then now the most recent one, Why America Failed, where he traces the failure of American culture and American ideology all the way back to its roots, because it was all of these people who moved over here from Europe who were the people who were looking to make a buck. And he goes into much more detail about why and how it played out. But essentially, his core point is that all the myths that American society is built on have spread around the world and have also integrated into other cultures. And so even though it's the American core that is failing, the periphery, the other places, may even fail faster. I know you were in Spain at the time of this recording, Seth. And what was it like to be in Spain and see so much influence of American culture there in another country?
I was in Spain, and every time I'm in Europe, you can always find the Americans just based on the way they're speaking. But this time around, I could really see the American culture just permeating everywhere in Spain. So I saw incredible capitalistic Christmas going on all around me, McDonald's and Starbucks everywhere I looked. And, you know, just the incorporation of so many different American TV shows and all sorts of American fashion there as well. It was very poignant that I was there at that time when I was having this conversation with Morris, so that I could actually illustrate some of the things from that of an American, maybe a bit more of an American in Europe kind of perspective. It made me feel a little bit sad to be American there in Europe, as American culture has kind of crept across the land and across the world. It's kind of a sad thing to see, and sometimes I feel a little bit bad that American culture has just taken over these ancient cultures that have been around for so many years, and it makes me a little bit sad on the inside. What do you feel, Justin, living in Canada? Do you see a lot of American culture in Canada?
Well, absolutely. The only difference between a Canadian and an American is that a Canadian is an American without the gun, is what I always hear. It's a lot like the United States here, but it's just slightly different, maybe slightly nicer. And one of the things that I realized when I was in Europe earlier in 2011 was just how embarrassing it is sometimes to meet other Americans traveling. And I was staying in a hostel in Marseille, France, and I was sitting there in my room, and right outside the door, the whole night, starting at 11 p.m., there was this guy there from Georgia, and he was talking about how proud he was to be a redneck and how his favorite beer was Bud Light, and he was sitting around with all of these German guys, and he was talking about how he would drink so much he would just pass out drunk in on the street, and he was describing tailgating to them when he would go to a Georgia Bulldogs football game and tailgate, and he was saying, you know, like people would drive their big trucks in and put their grills out on the truck, and you know, just get really, really drunk before the football game. And then he, some girls started yelling outside the window to him, like, shut up, we're trying to sleep. It's 2 a.m. and you're being unbelievably loud and keeping everyone in the hostel up. And he was like, why don't you come down here, sweetie? And, oh, man, it was so awful. It just, it made me so embarrassed.
You know, we are pretty mean to Americans. We're pretty hard on Americans on this show. And that is because we're both Americans and we lived within this culture for so long.
Well, and one of the things I read in one of John Michael Greer's recent books is, you know, he takes kind of the whole criticism of the United States and he says, post-World War II, like, imagine if Japan or imagine if Germany had become the world superpower, you know, what would it be like? And yes, there are so many horrible negative things about the way that the United States empire exists on this globe. But, you know, in other ways, it's like, what are the trade-offs?
Yeah, Justin, it would be kind of crazy if, you know, Germany would have won that World War II. You know, we'd have Hitler spreading fascism all over the world. That would have been a very drastically different place. So I suppose America coming out on top of World War II was probably was the best of any of the possible scenarios that could have happened.
We're headed towards an age where there won't be superpowers, for better or for worse. And there will still be powers. But what that means is that there's going to be more pluralism. And so we're going to find out what that means here on this planet. But for now, we're going to find out what Morris Berman has to say. And so let's take it away.
You're listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR 101.9 FM. And today we're talking with Morris Berman about why America failed.
So we'll start out by taking the title of the book, Why America Failed. Why did America fail? And who's willing to ask themselves such a question in our culture today? Because for some reason, the United States has such a hard time with cultural reflection.
It really does. In fact, one of the greatest reflectors, so to speak, on the American psyche, American history, and the forces that have propelled the United States in the direction it has gone, is a Canadian. I'm referring to Sacklin Berkovich, who taught American studies at Harvard for decades and wrote books like The Puritan Origins of the American Self, and whose insight, as an outsider, his insight into American psychological behavior is second to none. In fact, at one point, he said, it took me a while to adjust. It was almost as though I were observing the people who were insane. And I would agree with him. That's my verdict as well. So, but it's easier to see if you're coming from the outside, entering, and you see all these people mouthing these slogans. I talk about that in particular in one essay in a collection of essays I did called A Question of Values I posted about a year ago. And there's one essay called Conspiracy versus Conspiracy in American History, in which I talk about the unconscious programming that has led Americans to behave, think, and act the way they do. And it's unconscious programming like the belief that we're the chosen people, or that there's an endless frontier and we can operate on the basis of infinite resources, despite, you know, the obvious fact that we can't. But that's still going on right now in the United States, that belief. And so Berkovich was really good, I think, at scoring the religious basis of this kind of unconscious programming, the belief that we are the chosen people, and that the history of the United States was, from the early 16th century, seen as the unfolding of God's will on earth. And a lot of Americans still believe that, even ones who are secular and say they don't believe it. As a result of which, it is almost impossible to criticize the United States to Americans in anything but a more than extremely mild sort of way. They cannot tolerate it because the civil religion itself is the United States, regardless of a person is Protestant, Jewish, or whatever. The civil religion is the United States, and you know what happens if you attack somebody's religion. So there is a Manichaean structure of inside all good, outside all bad. We might make exceptions here and there, for example, for Canadians. But by and large, the outside world's evil, the inside world's good, and that's how Americans operate. Alexis de Tocqueville recognized this as early as 1831. He said, Americans are in a perpetual state of self-adoration. And the minute that you suggest any kind of criticism, make any kind of criticism whatsoever, they get very fierce and very angry. This is 1831. It's worse now, of course, nearly 200 years later than it was then. So that's some of the background that I would give you about the difficulty of criticizing the United States and, as a result, the difficulty of any real change taking place. I say this over and over again. It's simply not going to happen. It's not merely the government or institutions. It's the average guy, the average man or woman just walking around the streets. I mean, they can be unemployed. They can have their house foreclosed on. They can be living in a gutter, but these 10 cities fly an American flag over them, and they still believe that.
You mentioned the unconscious programming and the perpetual state of self-adoration that Americans have. And I think it's really interesting about the fact that so much bad media and bad cultural values come out of this country, out of the American country, and it influences the whole world. I'm staying in Spain right now, and many of my friends love watching American television. I look outside and everybody is shopping for Christmas. I see Santa Claus in the window. I see McDonald's on the side of the road, and I see Starbucks where it's packed. And you ask anybody and everyone will say that American stuff is the best. American cultural icons and media stuff is the best, aside from, you know, olive oil in Spain and you know, the few specific things that each country makes. Why do you think that American culture and values permeates the whole world in the way it does?
That's a very important question. That's an extremely important question. Just to add to that list, a few months ago I read something that I thought was both horrible and hilarious. The number one television show in Gaza Strip, in Gaza, the number one television show is Friends. You know, the American sitcom.
Yeah, so they play that here in Spain as well. It's amazing. They laugh. And,
right, but I don't expect Palestinians to sit around thinking that some American sitcom is great, and yet they do. Spain, I can understand. Europe, I can understand. But Gaza, give me a break. Why would, I mean, here you have the Palestinians who loathe American politics, the government. After all, it's oppressing them. It's giving $3 billion a year to Israel to, you know, for materiel and make sure that the thumb remains on, you know, on the back of the neck of the Palestinians. Why would they? But they do. And there you have it. And there are a number of ways of answering that question, which I think is a really good one. One being that soft power is much more powerful than hard power, even though the United States government doesn't quite grasp that. It's still very foolish. I mean, this recent business of putting a military base in Australia to rattle sabers at China, you couldn't do a more stupid thing than that. So hard power is the thing that the government, the military, they all love that. But it backfires. That's what blowback is. It doesn't work out very well. There's retaliation against it. It's a very stupid thing to do. Whereas soft power, that's a different story. Rather than blowback, there's an enormous embrace. Soft power is Walt Disney, jeans, Christmas, consumer society, friends, and all that sort of stuff. And the world absolutely loves it, not realizing that they're taking in a poison that's killing them, and they take it in. They do take it in quite eagerly. Explanations for this, you know, frankly, the best I ran across is by the Chilean writer. He lives in the United States now, but he was born and raised in Chile and left when Allende was killed. It's Ariel Dorfman, who teaches at Duke University. Dorfman wrote a book, The Empire Has No Clothes, something like that. It was about 1983, where he wrote a book, and towards the end, he talked about the fact that there's this enormous embrace of Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and all the sorts of things that the United States produces. And he said the reason is transcultural and even biological. It's that there is an enormous human identification with the child within us, to have fun, to celebrate the child, to protect the child. And Americans play that chord extremely well. Certainly Walt Disney understood it extremely well. And so the embrace is almost a biological one. I would extend it to things like iPhones and smartphones and all these cell phone applications and BlackBerries and iPads. The idea of having toys. I mean, America is, to me, a very infantile culture. It never really grew up. It's not even adolescent. Well, it is in some ways, but it's largely an infantile culture. And the idea of creating toys, I mean, even when you listen to people like Bill Gates, here's an adult saying, we've got a lot of neat stuff. Who talks like that? Children talk like that. And that's what Americans want. They want neat stuff. But Dorfman was right in saying that there's, on a biological level, everybody wants neat stuff. It just appeals to the child within us, and that is a archetypal, if you will, almost a Jungian category. It's a transcultural kind of thing, and American corporations know, certainly Disney did, but other corporations as well, know how to manipulate, know how to pluck their cord. And they can go in, and now there are iPads designed for infants 7 days old. In fact, it was a Canadian company. I read about it recently, and I can't remember the name. But it was called Vinci, V-I-N-C-I. And it's an iPad for infants 7 days old. That's how early corporations want to hook children into staying children all their lives. And so I think
7 months old. That's
7 days. 7 days. At 7 days of age, the newborn is now fiddling around with an iPad. And the company, the device is called Vinci. And I can't remember, it's a Canadian company. And I remember reading about it in American newspapers. There's a whole article about it. I can't remember the name of the company. It's a woman who runs it. And she was very excited. And she talked in corporate terms. We're leveraging this, you know. And, you know, this is mental illness to the max. So toddlers now have iPads, cell phones, and are taking Prozac. You know, they're armed for the new life. What a great way to live. You know, I mean, it's the end of the human being. It is Brave New World. And
yeah, I was just going to say, that's just like Soma, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So if you stay an infant all your life, this is what it looks like. And I think Dorfman hit something very important. This goes beyond any kind of Marxist analysis of corporate control and all this sort of thing. That's there, but the corporations know how to pluck that string and how to move in and invade the mind of the infant and to keep Americans and, for that matter, Canadians and, to a great extent, Mexicans, children for life.
So we've been talking about the juvenile aspects of American culture, and we live in this time of economic collapse and decline, and we see financial crises all over the world. And more than anything else, the United States has been a country of endless economic growth. That's been the philosophy. And in speaking about the juvenile nature, it's really interesting that you brought that up, because in the biological development of any being, growth is the development phase, the juvenile phase in the life cycle of any one organism. So not only are we juvenile in the way that we appeal to the juvenile around the world, but our economic philosophy does the same. Where did our economic philosophy start in the history of the United States? And really, has it been with us throughout our entire history since everyone from Europe started coming over to this new world?
Another good question. Of course, there are differences with Canada. At the time of the Revolution, loyalists left. You know, they went north. There's a good book by Maya Jasanoff, actually, called Liberty's Exiles, that I would recommend to our listeners, that talks about the Americans that didn't agree with the separation from England and what happened to them. And perhaps, you know, in that way, one can learn about a slight difference in any case. It's not large anymore, but a slight difference in value systems between Canada, the U.S., U.S. and Mexico, and so on, and maybe, you know, the U.S. and Europe. But I would argue that the decline was embedded in the rise, and this is the dialectical part of the whole argument. Many years ago, an historian named Lewis Hartz, and this was in 1955, did a book called The Liberal Tradition in America. Now, liberal here does not mean that word as it usually is tossed around. That is to say, politically leftward or something like that. It means that in a political, colloquial sense. But strictly speaking, the word liberal means conservative. That is to say, liberal always meant 19th century British economics, John Stuart Mill, Ricardo, and so on. This was the liberal tradition. The liberal tradition in America, said Hartz, is that we were capitalists from the get-go, from the very earliest point, and it came about because there are a number of societies or nations, he said, on the planet that are what he calls fragment societies. That is to say, they broke off from a mother culture, in the case of England, in the case of the United States, from England. They broke off from another culture, but they didn't take the whole culture. They just took one particular strand of it, and they made it into their entire culture. And what the United States was, the particular strand it took, was the British entrepreneurial, middle-class, aggressive, capitalist faction, that strand. That became the whole of the United States. It was covered over with a rhetoric of democracy, some of which had a reality to it, I mean, in the sense of being republican and anti-monarchical and so on. But, says Hartz, the crux of it, and he's not the only one, a whole list of very good historians have argued this, the crux of it was economic expansion, the acquisition of property and the acquisition of things. And that was what the United States was from the beginning. That created a very lopsided situation, because if you're about only one particular thing, your days are really numbered in a certain way. That formula gave the United States immense expansionist power within 100 years of its founding, of the Declaration of Independence. It's one-third of the products sold in the world were manufactured in the U.S. That's, you know, it's pretty good. But the downside of that is that that's all it was about, and that creates a very lopsided society. You know, I wrote this third volume in the trilogy. It's called Why America Failed, but the original, the working title was Capitalism and Its Discontents. My publisher was not keen on that because, as I like to say, he wanted me to sell more than six books, you know. So he wanted a non-academic title, one that would grab the public attention, like Why America Failed. Okay, so finally I agreed with that. But
most people wouldn't get the Freud reference.
That's right. That's yeah. Absolutely right. And it's also the case, for me, it was a better title, even though, you know, I admit it's not a good marketing title. But I like the title because it really said what it was about. What you have in the United States is capitalism, and then you have its discontents. And capitalism, as an ideology, frame of mind, way of life, outweighed the discontents by, like, you know, 10,000 to 1. The alternative voice in the United States really had never had much of a chance. Whether we're talking, I mean, it goes back quite a ways. It goes back to the really to the beginning, Captain John Smith in 1616 and the Puritan divines, even John Winthrop to a great extent in 1630 on the Arabella, tracing it down through folks like Lewis Mumford and Jane Jacobs and Vance Packard and John Kenneth Galbraith and right down to Jimmy Carter, which was the alternative tradition's last stand, really. And it never really had a chance. It was a spiritual and exhortatory kind of position. The only alternative culture in the United States to the hustling world was the American South, which obviously had its own complications and its own dark side, being based as it was on slavery. But this is the truth of the matter is that the alternative tradition never had a voice and doesn't to this day. I mean, for every copy of Why America Failed that's going to sell, these neoliberal writers or Ann Coulter or any of these folks will sell 10,000 copies. The alternative tradition doesn't have a voice. It can't get heard, and it won't. Now, we need to ask, I suppose, what's Occupy Wall Street about? Is it the alternative tradition or is it something else? I'm not entirely certain. But I do know that the chances of it getting anywhere in terms of power, probably slight. And what I would predict is that it will be marginalized, just like the alternative tradition always has been, and maybe float into a situation where it constitutes a sort of permanent rump society, a kind of teach-in, where you can go down to Zuccotti Park, let's say, and, you know, hear lectures on various things from the alternative tradition. But that, again, is an imitation of Brave New World, where Huxley had those who opted out of the whole commercial, technological, consumerist control of life and way of life, just lived in sort of like Indian reservations, you know, on the margin, and were sort of the detritus of society, in quotes, and while the rest of the society pursued the dominant culture's values. I mean, it's unfortunate in a way, but I'm, of course, glad that Occupy Wall Street occurred. I would love it if their ranks swelled from 20,000 to 200 million. I don't think it's going to happen.
And in speaking about the dominant culture and building this alternative culture, you mentioned your essay in regards to conspiracy. And there's so many people who just say we either have to take on the Bilderbergs or the Illuminati or whoever's controlling society. And is that the case? I mean, are there these dark forces out there controlling everything? Are they part of a master plan or is it something else?
Well, I don't buy that myself. I mean, that's a very old kind of theory, and it always exists. I mean, you know, going back to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, if not before. I mean, there are people walking around the United States believing that, you know, the Jews are manipulating everything from some basement in a synagogue. There are groups and there are collusions, but that it's all being controlled by, you know, one cabal, that strikes me as being very unlikely. What I talk about in that essay, Conspiracy versus Conspiracy, is that we don't really have a conspiracy of elites for the most part. It does happen once in a while, but we don't have a conspiracy of elites so much in the sense of people getting together in a boardroom, rolling up their sleeves and saying, how can we get control of the whole country? How can the six of us get control of the whole country and screw everybody up? What it's more like, and this follows the line of C. Wright Mills in The Power Elite, he pegged it very well. He said, you know, it's more social. These people meet at the same, on the golf course, they meet at the same country clubs. They take cruises together, and they are on the boards of the same newspapers and media. And that's how they run into each other, and they discover that this person is the same class as I am. This person has the same values. And so they make deals. I mean, well, you know, it's just basically self-interest, and that's how politics works. But the funny thing is, the thing that is ironic about the whole thing, the net effect is the same as if it were a cabal meeting in a boardroom, rolling up their sleeves and saying, how can we get control of the whole country? Because that's what's happened. And so what Mills said was, it doesn't really work that way, except the outcome is that. You know, that's what we have to deal with, as though that were true. Well, it makes, obviously, it makes it harder because the enemy is everywhere in that sense. What are you going to run around to golf courses and country clubs? And, you know, I mean, you can go down to Wall Street and you can, you know, try to drag those people out into the street and ship them off to The Hague, to the world court, to be tried as financial terrorists. I think that would be a great outcome. But it's not likely, and in any case, that's not the whole locus of the thing. You know, Lloyd Blankfein and John Corzine and so on, they're like heads on a hydra. It spreads everywhere. So I think it's larger than a you know, a Bilderberg group or something like that. But, you know, who knows what the reality is? We're not going to know for certain.
So moving back in time a little bit, could you maybe explain to us a little bit about what the early 1800s in America was like? And do you have any insight that might be able to tell us what life was like back then?
Well, you know, as I said, starting from the late 16th century when the continent was first being colonized, it was colonized by that fragment of the British middle class that saw it as real estate. And basically the chartered companies that came over in the Virginia Commonwealth and so on were chartered British corporations. And so this was the goal. It was that this was going to be a field day for economic expansion, and it was. And so this was going on from something like 1584 and onward. It only was really heightened during the War of Independence, the American Revolution. In fact, John Adams wrote in his diary, I never saw such an avaricious people in my whole life. This was in the middle of the Revolution, where you had all this ideological and idealistic stuff about republicanism and democracy and so on, which I said was real on one hand and was a cover on the other hand. So by the time things settle in, let's take the year 1800. It's a very interesting one. Jefferson ran for president and won. One thing he used literature of a British authorship that talked about consumers forming the nation, and this was what the nation was supposed to be about. So one can see Jefferson, and I think correctly so, in an agrarian light, and yet at the same time, for him, the Jeffersonian Republicans were about making money and accumulating property. I think he had something like 150 slaves when he died, and he didn't free them. I mean, they were inherited. They were passed on as property in his will to his progeny. So you have a situation in which this kind of go-getting capitalism is the dominant theme all the time, and also with technological innovation. After all, shortly after 1800, you have the start of the building of the Erie Canal, the canal network that spreads across the United States, and then, of course, the railroad network that spreads across the United States, and then the electrical grid, and so on and so forth. Finally, in the early 20th century, the rise of vast houses of brokering and department stores like Macy's and Fields. It was an ever-expanding type of thing, which has its own type of marvelous power. You know, it's just, as I said, that dialectically, it's going to catch up with you eventually. And it does, because in order to keep those markets going, you need foreign markets. And for that, you need an army. And for that, you need control of other nations, even if it's directly imperialistic or an economic type of imperialism. And sooner or later, you know what? They're going to get pissed off. They're going to strike back, which is what happened on 9/11. Or the system is going to start to implode, as happened in 1929 and in 2008. And 2008 is not the last implosion. And 9/11 is not going to be the last attack, because basically the United States, you know, when you set yourself up, Kissinger said it, when you set yourself up as a hegemon and you have to control everything, you know what? People don't like it, and they're going to strike back. And finally, I would estimate by 2025, which is only 14 years away, the United States is going to look very different. It's going to look very second class and kind of irrelevant, or getting there, on a world scale.
I'm not afraid to taste your fist. I'm not afraid to taste your fist. I'm going to learn American. I'm going to learn American. Drip, drip from a chin. Drip, drip from a chin. I'm going to learn American. I'm going to learn American. Your head is as low as your face. Your head is as low as your face. I'm going to learn American. I'm going to learn American. Your name is in search of a friend. Your name is in search of a friend. Your face, your head is as numb as your face. I'm gonna learn American. I'm gonna learn American. Your name is in search of a friend. Your name is in search of a friend. I'm gonna learn American. I'm gonna learn American.
We are following the trajectory of all empires, which is that they expand beyond their capacity to sustain themselves. We have run up the largest deficits in human history, which in the bottom line is we can't repay it. We have done so at the cost of our infrastructure, our public education, our working class. We're hollowing the country out from the inside, and the physical evidence is all around us, plunging roughly one-third of Americans into poverty or near poverty, according to the latest statistics. Our bridges, our roads are collapsing, libraries are being closed, fire stations are being closed. These are the signs of a nation, or let's call it an empire, that is reaching a kind of a terminal point. And if we don't radically rechart our course, then the collapse is going to be very frightening and very chaotic.
These are challenging and important times for America. We want and deserve solutions. We can regain the world's respect by standing strong again, being true to our faith, and respecting one another.
Detroit's been ravaged by industrial decline, unemployment, and crime. Property prices have crashed, and the population of Detroit has simply collapsed.
Sometimes I get discouraged and I get weary, and I tell my husband, let's get out of here. But then I think about it, I think we ordained to stay, because how the kids come to us, how they open up to us. I think that God placed us here to do a work.
And the work they do is to provide food, shelter, and real-world counseling in an area where poverty, drug dealing, and violence are often a way of life.
It's a domino effect, basically. No jobs, you pick the gun up. No guidance, you run wild.
Man, it's just so hard out here, man. Like, it's so hard, like, you wouldn't even know which way to step to go to the right direction.
I believe the American people are overtaxed and the government is overfed. I believe we're spending too much money, and that's got to stop. We face attack from jihadists. We face tougher competition than we've ever known before coming from Asia. We're spending too much money here.
Not living in poverty, but not making it either. Many too ashamed to show their face. We met this young mother at a New Jersey food pantry she used to donate to. But today, she came for help.
Why did I meet you here today?
5 kids, 1 bag of chicken left in the house, and it's only 4 pieces in there.
She's not even 30, a mother of 3, and helping take care of 2 other children. Her job, she says, a victim of downsizing. But it wasn't always this way.
2009, for you, life was good.
Mm-hmm. It was great, you know, 3 cars, house, kids. Kids had whatever they needed.
Did you ever think that you would be living with your 3 kids in a shelter?
No. I never thought in a million years that I would be at this point this bad. I was working. The money that I was making, I was able to pay my bills.
Pay your rent.
Be able to have excess things and enjoy life. Until I got laid off from my job.
Nearly 1 in 2 Americans is now living on the lower end of the income scale. For a family of 4, that's less than $45,000 a year.
And have people hit the end of their rope?
I think so. Their resources are gone.
The recession may be over, but it doesn't feel that way. 2011 was the busiest year in the 35-year history of the Center for Food Action.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We're seeing a tremendous increase, and much of that increase has to do with people that never, ever thought that they were going to need
so
to come to an emergency
center.
People
that were
middle
class?
People that were donors, people that always thought that they were on the giving side are suddenly finding themselves needing help.
I think what we're seeing is that the middle class is going away. I'm nervous for a lot of people. Families that do have educations and had decent jobs are now being laid off.
These are the families that are stuck in the middle.
Exactly.
Aren't they?
They fall through the cracks.
And there's a lot of them.
There are a lot of them. But that's the frightening part.
I never thought I'd be here. I don't know why I had to go through this.
I believe in the people of America. Free American people are the source of this land's great strength.
And Mitt has a detailed plan to turn around America's economy. Mitt Romney.
What if the two-party system was actually a mechanism used to limit so-called public opinion? What if there were more than two sides to every issue, but the two parties wanted to box you into a corner, one of their corners? What if there's no such thing as public opinion, because every thinking person has opinions that are uniquely his own? What if what we call public opinion was just a manufactured narrative that makes it easier to convince people that if their views are different, then there's something wrong with that, or there's something wrong with them? What if the widely perceived differences between the two parties was just an illusion? What if the heart of the government policy remains the same no matter who's in the White House? What if the heart of government policy remains the same no matter what the people want? What if those vaunted differences between Democrat and Republican were actually just minor disagreements?
Restore Our Future, Inc. is responsible for the content of this message.
I'm Newt Gingrich, and I approve this message.
I'm Mitt Romney. I'm running for president, and I approve this message.
What is inner peace? What is our human potential? Experience the answers for yourself with free weekly sessions on self-knowledge for inner change. Sessions run weekly at the YWCA Hotel Meeting Room, 733 Beattie Street, starting Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m., ending March 12th. Contact info at consciousrealization.com for more information.
You are listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR 101.9 FM. And today, we're speaking with Morris Berman about why America failed. So given what you said about swindling and hustling as part of American life and American values for a very long time, why is it that everyone acts so surprised when Goldman Sachs screws us over and when, you know, people like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates make a fortune, and we all look at those people and want to be them instead of criticizing them for amassing so much wealth? Why are we so surprised when it happens?
I always come back to a remark that, you know, the great American writer John Steinbeck made. He said that in the United States, poor people regard themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. In other words, you know, that, I mean, they just see themselves on the road to becoming Bill Gates. The fact that this is a hallucination, a delusion of the first order, never even enters their minds. After all, Americans are raised on variants of Horatio Alger. You know, the famous Horatio Alger stories, especially around the early 20th century, where they're stories of the self-made man. The statistics are that most Americans die in the class into which they were born, and that most of the wealth is long-term wealth. It's not like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. Those are the exceptions, or Oprah Winfrey. Those are the exceptions that are always held up. Anybody can make it, but in fact, anybody can't make it. It really is an accidental type of thing. However, the ideology in the United States is extremely powerful. in that regard. And most Americans have it. If you work hard enough, everything will work out. They even believe it in the midst of living in a tent city, having their house foreclosed on, having no money at all, no job, and no prospect of a job, economists now tell us, for about 10 years. They still believe it. They are temporarily embarrassed millionaires, as Steinbeck said. When Roy Blankfein of Goldman Sachs gave himself a bonus a year ago of about $9 million, President Obama said, well, most Americans don't begrudge him that money. After all, that's how capitalism works. That's how free enterprise works. And most Americans, you know, would like to be in the same position. That's exactly correct. That's exactly correct. It's not that most Americans look at Blankfein or a character like Bill Gates, who at one point had $50 billion in the bank, or a character like Steve Jobs, who died with $8 billion, and say, any system that allows one person to amass that much wealth at the expense of everybody else is perverse. They don't say that at all. They say, how can I get a cut of that pie? How can I become Steve Jobs? How can I invent some pet rock or some piece of junk that's going to make it for me? That's where their attention is. They want to be Blankfein and Gates and so on. And greed doesn't start with Ronald Reagan in 1981. Greed starts with these real estate promotional tracts published in England in 1584 saying, go over there and get your cut. That's where greed starts, and that's the 400-plus years history of the United States.
And we have those examples of the Horatio Alger stories that paint the picture of a world where if you work hard enough and pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that you really can make it. And you follow the formula and you work hard enough and everything will work out. And there's so many people working incredibly hard at such useless things. And do you think that that work ethic, that American work ethic to try and try and try and never give up, will break down as more U.S. citizens realize that breaking out of that class stagnation or that cultural box that they've been sold is really not going to happen, and they're just going to continue to live in the same way that they have for so long?
Yeah, I think they're going to continue. Again, it's a question of how would we translate or decode what's going on with Occupy Wall Street. I could be wrong about this. I haven't been to Zuccotti Park. I haven't talked to the people there, and I could be way off base here. My impression from online news reports and coverage, including from very sympathetic and left-wing websites, for example, is that protesters in Zuccotti Park are not protesting the American dream. They're protesting an American dream that's poorly distributed. In other words, the position is largely socialist. It's that the country is not fair. It needs to distribute the wealth more evenly so that they always say 1%, 99%, but actually the figures are 190. That is to say, the top 1% in collective wealth hold more than the bottom 90% in collective wealth. So they want to redistribute it. They want a fairer system. That seems to be the goal. I don't pick up very much online along the lines of, but there's something wrong with the American dream itself. If there's something wrong with the whole narrative of American history. In fact, most Americans don't even know what a narrative is, let alone know what the narrative of America is. Sackville Berkovich understood it, wrote a lot about it. How many Americans do you think read Sackville Berkovich? Furthermore, Americans are not very bright. I have to say it. If you would stop a typical American on the street and you'd say, can you define the word narrative? Can you say what a narrative is? I would guess that 1 out of 1,000 would be able to say, well, it's kind of a collective myth or a story that guides the behavior or course of history or understanding of the people and so on. I don't know about Canada, but my guess is in France, 99 out of 100 would be able to say, c'est quoi un narratif? Oh, oui, oui, c'est ça. C'est une histoire, blah, blah. You can bet that the French understand what a narrative is. Probably the Germans and Italians as well. Americans are not very bright. They don't think in these terms. What they do is they live inside the narrative, which means that you can never correct the narrative. That's why you have tent cities flying the American flag. It's not that the people in the tent cities are saying, oh, there's something wrong entirely in its conception with the American dream. No, no, it's I didn't get my share of the American dream, and that's what I want now. Now, I suspect that's what the Wall Street protesters are saying, that it's an issue of distribution. It's not for them that it's an issue of actual conception. Because, you know, when you think about it, one of these unconscious programs or narratives that I'm talking about in that essay I mentioned in Question of Values was that of the endless frontier, that we will never run out of resources, energy, or whatever it is. And in fact, that's quite nuts. That would be a philosophy that's based on infinity, which doesn't exist in the real world. But Americans believe it exists, and they'll stay within that narrative. They'll stay inside of it. You know, I remember years ago, it was the only time I run across this. I was staying in Utah for a while, and I met a woman. She wasn't a Mormon, but whatever. I met this woman who was working for IBM, setting up mainframes for large institutions like hospitals. And I said, how do you like your work? She said, it's okay. I mean, there's nothing splendid about it, but it pays very well and so on. As I got to know her, it turned out that she had gotten a bachelor's degree from some major university in the Northeast in urban anthropology and had done an undergraduate honors thesis on the urban anthropology of some African city or something like that. And she said, you know, when I finished that work, I saw through the myth of the United States. You can't study anthropology without, you know, first you study the myths of other countries, and finally it occurs to you, well, what are ours? What are our narratives? And I saw what it was, and I saw the mythology of the United States, and I made a decision not to think about it anymore. In fact, this is the first time I've thought about it since I got my bachelor's degree. I just went to work for IBM. I realized that the choice was to live the myth or to live outside it and analyze it. And I decided to live within the myth. It was sort of like a postmodern conversation. It was the most incredible conversation I had had up to that point. Certainly, I'd never run into anybody who said, I saw through it, and I decided to go back to sleep because that would be better for my life. It was incredible to me that anybody who saw through it could then make that decision. But, you know, Joan or whatever her name was, I can't remember, was an extremely unusual character. Most Americans don't get to the point. They don't study anthropology. They don't live anywhere else. Only 12% of Americans have a passport. Only 12% travel outside the country, Canada and Mexico excepted. They don't know what other cultures are like, and they don't know there are other possibilities. And so they live entirely within a kind of sphere that's lined with mirror material on the inside, where everything reflects back into them and says the same thing over and over again, and they can't break out of it. It's like that movie, The Matrix. That's what the United States is. It's a large hologram in which nobody, fresh air doesn't really enter here, and most people don't get to the point of saying, what is the narrative, because they can't even formulate the question in the United States. In that sense, this has to be one of the most successful political formations in the history of the world, because basically, no matter how badly the government screws up, the people still say, we're number one.
Absolutely. And you mentioned tent cities flying the American flag and the American myth of the infinite frontier now being crushed by physical reality. You know, we're running up against hard limits, the limits to growth that have been talked about for over 40 years now. And essentially, the American dream for many is becoming the American nightmare. And you would hope that as things deteriorate, people would look back through history and find, you know, alternatives that have existed not only in the United States but around the world and start embracing those in their lives. But yet, why is it that the people who were opposed to luxury in the United States, who really wanted the simple life, were so heavily marginalized throughout American history? Are there any solid alternative movements inside the United States that we can turn to and say, you know, they had something that was of value and we can adapt that to our situation now?
The only exception that had clout was the American South. That is to say, you have Emerson and Thoreau and Lewis Mumford and so on, but they're just regarded as cranks or as quaint, you know. I mean, Herman Melville, which is a theme in my book, Why America Failed, Herman Melville really understood, and if only in an unconscious way, I really don't know how aware of it he was, but the story of the ship, the Pequod, being smashed to pieces by the whale, was the narrative of the United States, that if you continue to pursue this laissez-faire technological economics in this monomaniacal way, like Ahab did, you can only come to ruin. And that's the story, you know. So in terms of what happened to alternatives, the only alternative. I mean, Melville's book didn't sell. Moby Dick didn't sell. He was a, you know, had to make a living as a customs official, and he died in relative obscurity. He was the greatest writer America ever produced. But this is the problem, that it was all exhortatory. You know, Lewis Mumford, you read him today, he's right on target. Also, most Americans would just laugh, you know. So what do we have? The only alternative tradition that was opposed to the hustling life, and bitterly opposed to it, was the American South. And it was the only alternative tradition that had guns, that had the military might to say, you're not putting us there. We're not going to that place. You're not going to do a northern makeover of the South. And they went to war over it and had the capability of doing it. Of course, the dark shadow is the whole thing, that the economy was based on slavery. And, you know, is that any better? I mean, obviously, it had to go by 1861. It had to go. And so that war that cost over 600,000 lives had to be fought. And that's the great tragedy, I think, of American history, because not only the loss of that life, but the loss of a way of life. Because if you look at the South and subtract slavery, just for a moment, put it aside, you say, hey, everybody should have this way of life. This was, in fact, in 1860, again, slavery accepted, the dominant pattern throughout the world. It wasn't a North American or Northern European hustling way of life. That was the minority tradition. The great American historian, Southern historian, C. Van Woodward, said that in essays he wrote in the 1950s. He said, really, it wasn't the South that was peculiar on a world scale. It was the North. Most nations of the world weren't into hustling and weren't into that highly expansionist way of life. This was something that then, when the South was crushed, since the South was associated with slavery, and this is the worst thing in the world, and it is brutal, but the problem is that what they were talking about as a way of life got lost. And there were some pretty humane values. In humanity, there were some pretty humane values. It makes the history of the United States, and especially Civil War, kind of maddening. Because as I say in the chapter of Why America Failed on the Civil War, it's paradoxical and almost crazy-making that the best of the South and the worst of the South were tied together at the root. And we can separate it theoretically, but in terms of how it played out, of course, we can't. And so we are then left with, as the historian Eugene Genovese said about the South and what happened, as a result of that, we are left with a world that can be characterized as affluent depravity. What are we living for? It's just for more. It's the hustling world. It's just the huge wealth of the top tenth of 1% taking over the globe. This is affluent depravity. This is, in a sense, almost as bad as slavery. That's what we wound up with. Ironically enough, the victory of the North opened the door to the American imperial program and the enslavement of millions of people around the world to America and to that way of life. So this is the kind of paradox that history, unfortunately, is made of.
So you're saying now we did away with legally enforced slavery and have wound up with wage slavery in a way?
Yeah, I mean, that's what happened. You know, in 1859, Lincoln, who, you know, had his eye on the presidency and was a, you know, major figure in the American scene by then, said that 60% of the American workforce was self-employed, and that was the course of events. You started off working for somebody else, and then you became the self-made man, like he said he was. You move up the ranks, you start your own company, and you become your own capitalist, and that was the vision he had for the United States. His vision was not that of freed slaves, it was of free men, that is to say, people who could become self-made men, capitalists on their own, and so on. But in 1859, when he was saying that 60% fell into the category of self-employed, we know that's wrong. In fact, it was about 12%. It was about one-eighth of the workforce that was categorized, could be categorized in that way. The rest were working for other people or corporations with no possibility of ever escaping that noose. And they didn't. And they don't today. And so when Lincoln was saying this, John Calhoun and other Southerners were saying, you can excoriate our system of slavery, but yours is just wage slavery. Now, I would still maintain there's a difference between being a free person and a slave person, regardless of, you know, how much money you're making or what the conditions are. It's always better to be free, it seems to me. But the actual material, they were right about the actual material conditions. They were grueling, and we now have, you know, where did Steve Jobs, that everybody adores, get his money from? From 14-year-old Chinese teenagers working 14 hours a day in Shenzhen for 14 cents an hour, and beaten and frequently raped and the whole schmear. And you know what? He had controlling interest in that city, in that country, sorry, in that company, and he could have done something about it. I mean, he could have changed the working conditions for those people. But no, they die at age 30 from being worn out and making peanuts, and he dies with $8 billion. And then, it seems to me, to the everlasting shame of the American public walking around with candles, you know, near his house on the day he died, or the New Yorker running a cover showing Jobs coming up to heaven and the angel Gabriel having an iPad, or the general adulation on the part of the Occupy Wall Street protesters when he died. You know, a moment of silence for Steve Jobs. What are you thinking, for God's sakes? So this is the kind of thing that, you know, I think we're faced with, that this is the world, as Genovese says, of affluent depravity. That's what we got by defeating slavery. I want to go on record as saying I'm not pro-slave. I'm glad the war was fought and slavery was eradicated. This had to be, in the course of events. But it's not clear that what followed was any kind of liberation for Americans or, you know, the Chinese victims in apple factories in Shenzhen. It wasn't. Been told a long time ago, slipping and a sliding, peeping and a hiding. Been told a long time ago, I've been told, baby, you can't roll, I won't be your boo no more.
Thanks for listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR. Starting next week on Wednesday, February the 1st, we'll be joining you every week from 2 to 3 p.m. on Wednesdays.
That's right, Justin. CITR has picked us up, and now we are picking up another time slot, which is very exciting for us. So now you, as our listening audience, will be able to listen to the exciting voices of Justin and I both every week. So if you like what you hear on The Extra Environmentalist, check us out on our website at www.extraenvironmentalist.com. Find us on Facebook where you can like us, which we would be very happy if you did. Find us on Twitter at @extraenvironmental. Check out our blog at extraenvironmentalist.com/blog. Use voice communication at 919-701-9872, and that's a U.S. number, so you got to put a +1 on there, or by Skype. Email podcast@extraenvironmentalist.com. So once again, thank you so much for joining us on another episode of The Extra Environmentalist, and we look forward to hearing from you soon.
The pressure, economic, social, ethical, and religious pressure, invariably distort not only our action, but the quality of the brain. Language uses us rather than we use language. The instrument, which is the language, influences our action, our attitudes, thoughts, and so on. We don't use language. Language uses us. And therefore, language becomes an extraordinary pressure. I do not know if you have noticed it in your daily life. When you say, my wife, there's already a certain pressure. And we're saying also that when we use language, words, we realize that the word is not the thing, that the description is not the described, then language doesn't act or bring about a change in our attitudes and action. Ideals affect, oppress, and act as pressure upon our daily life. And is it possible not to have any ideals, but only deal with actually what is? Then there is no pressure whatsoever. Ideals bring about a conflict.
Welcome to CITR 101.9 FM. You're tuned into the Jukebox, which is a fill-in show, and my name's CJ. And first up, I've got for you the Shilohs with their song, Mickey.